More About Life in World Unseen. Recorded by Anthony Borgia. Preface. The spirit communicator of this book was known on Earth as Monsignor Robert Hugh Benson, a son of Edward White Benson, former Archbishop of Canterbury, and he was at the height of his renown, both as preacher and author, when I first met him many years ago. After he had passed from this life, I many times wondered as to his welfare. Through a spirit friend I was told that he was well and prospering, and that in time I should hear from him directly. Such eventually proved to be the case, and there commenced a series of scripts given by him, the first of which, Life in the World Unseen, gave an account in some detail of his actual passing. He recounted how, at the close of his earthly life, he was met by a former colleague named Edwin, and taken by him to the spirit world, where his home awaited him, a counterpart of his house on earth. After a brief rest he commenced his explorations, under Edwin's guidance, of the land of his new life. During the course of their rambles they met a young girl of great charm, named Ruth, also a newcomer to the spirit world, who joined them, and the three have been together ever since, closely associated in work and pleasure. In the scripts that have followed, Monsignor has dealt with an extensive variety of subjects in connection with the spirit world, not the least among them being his theology, which underwent a wholesale and drastic revision. His principal occupation is to meet people at their dissolution, and conduct them into the spirit world. Working with him in this are his friends, Edwin and Ruth. It has been my privilege and pleasure to act all along as his amanuensis for recording the scripts. Through other sources of communication we have had literally hundreds of gatherings, where he has brought with him a goodly company of spirit friends. In the present script, recorded by me in 1951, Monsignor recounts how Ruth and he, but without Edwin on this occasion, embarked upon one of their visits to Earth for escort duty, in this instance to a young lad of 18 years. Instead, however, of passing him into the care of other hands, as usually takes place, they invite him to stay with them in their home where he first awakens to his new life, and thereafter, when fully recovered, they set out upon escort duty of another kind, through the realms in which they live, to see the wonders and meet some of the people. Contents, Preface, I. A Passing 2. The Awakening 3. A First View 4. A Visit 5. Spirit Intercourse 6. Spirit Locomotion 7. The City 8. We Visit a Church 9. A Question of Age 10. A Lesson in Creation 11. The Man in the Cottage 12. Philosophers. Folly 13. A House in the Forest 14. Two Visitors 15. The Ruler of the Realms Epilogue, a passing, you will have read, I hope, the few prefatory words that my earthly amanuensis has written concerning myself, so allowing me to proceed at once to my narrative without going over old ground. It is now close upon 40 years since I stood upon the threshold of a new life when the moment of my dissolution came. During the passage of the last decade I have been enabled to give some account of life as it is lived in these parts of the spirit world wherein I am happy to be living. Life, you must know, is upon a gigantic scale here in the spirit world, how gigantic you can have very little conception until you yourself come to dwell among us. But because its magnitude is vast that is not as a that it is proportionately complex. Indeed, when one comes to compare the earth world with the spirit world, it is at once apparent how complex the earth world is, and how much simpler is life in the spirit world. This may seem an astonishing statement to make, nevertheless, it is a true one. That, however, is a subject which I will discuss with you later. And now, without further preamble, to my narrative. Situated in the city, which is not far from my home here, is a large building which carries out the important functions of an office of records and inquiries. Here knowledge is to be obtained upon an infinite range and variety of subjects and affairs. Of all these, what closely interests us at the moment is that department which deals with the actual passing of folk from the earth to the spirit world. Part of my work consists of helping people at the moment of their physical death, people of all kinds, of both sexes, of any religion or none and of all ages, from young folk to the aged. Working in conjunction with me are my two old friends, Edwin and Ruth. Sometimes Edwin is not with us, but Ruth and I almost always work together. Now you may wonder how we come to know when our services are needed, and who or what directs those services into the required quarter. The answer is a simple one: the Office of Records and Inquiries. It is not part of our normal functions to be fully acquainted with all or any of the methods employed in the gathering of information by this central office. All that Ruth and I are called upon to do is to apprise this office with the fact that we are both free to undertake whatever task may present itself, and we follow the simple procedure of awaiting notification that our services are desired. We were seated, then, upon a particular occasion in our house, which is itself a replica of my old home in Earth, when word reached us that our presence was desired at the central office. We at once proceeded thither, and were greeted by one whom we had come to know very well during the passage of years, as had come to know us. This man is a genial soul, of great kindness and comprehension, and his knowledge of those who work for him is prodigious. For it is by the application of this knowledge that he is enabled to send upon their various missions those of us who are exactly suited to the specific task in hand. There may appear to be a great similarity between one normal transition and another when viewed by earthly eyes, but from our point of view the variations are enormous. They are as great, in fact, as the variations in human personalities. What to the earthly beholder is the end of life, is to us and the person chiefly concerned, the beginning of a new one. It is with the personality that we have to deal, and according to the personality, to the knowledge or ignorance of spiritual matters of passing soul, so is our especial task governed and our course of action regulated. In short, every death is treated and served with strict regard to its essential requirements, so that we are allotted our various tasks with one eye, as it were, upon our capabilities, experience, temperament, and so on. Edwin, Ruth and I are decidedly of similar temperament, while our capabilities and experience have been augmented and broadened by long practice. As you can imagine, a great deal of patience has at times to be exercised when we are confronted with minds that are tenacious of old beliefs and ideas that bear no relationship with the truth and facts and realities of spirit life, and it may take much arduous work to free the newly arrived person of so much that is mentally inhibiting and spiritually retarding. You will see, then, the wisdom of choosing instruments who are ably suited in all respects to the work in hand, so that a difficult or awkward case may not be rendered more so. The spirit world never does things by halves, to use a familiar expression, and what might appear to be sheer precocity to the incarnate is clear wisdom to us who have to carry out the work. No trouble is spared. We have infinity of time, a vast amount of patience, together with the services of a multitude of people always available. There is no bungling, there are no mistakes, nothing is left to chance. Our principal in the 5 central office, therefore, knowing us, sends us upon our missions to Earth with complete confidence in his choice of ourselves, while for our part, we have complete confidence that we are not being given a task beyond our powers of performance. After a few friendly exchanges and kindly inquiries, our friend turned to the business in hand. A perfectly straightforward case, he informed us, and one that should present no unusual features. It is the passing, he said, of a lad, aged 18. A sprightly youth, mentally alert and receptive. I have kept this case for you both, as I think he will be useful to you later on when he has become accustomed to things. Would you care to take him to your home? It would be a good plan. We readily acquiesced. We then plied our friend with a few questions so that we should be as fully charged with information as possible. It appeared that the lad's earthly end was approaching rapidly, that he had no prejudice concerning the subject of life after death, His religious instruction had followed the usual lines but had not left any very great impression. There was a happy toleration between him and his parents, but no such strong affection as would introduce any complications of an emotional nature. The parents would regard the early death of their son as part of God's will, and they would therefore submit in accordance thereto. We were agreed that this certainly did seem to be a straightforward case enough, and we were not sorry, inasmuch as we had had number of very trying transitions of late, and welcomed this fresh one upon easier lines. You will no doubt wonder how we are directed at the outset of our labors to the actual chamber of death, to use a most lugubrious phrase. Incidentally, what a wealth of gloom and lamentation it conjures up. It seems as though all the most doleful phrases are specially reserved for the simple act of passing from a world to ours. Of course you do not need to remind me that from the point of view of those who are departing from a loved one, it is no time for cheerfulness and joy abounding. Yet were the truth known and realized, what a world of difference it would make, especially if that happy state of things were to exist or then that all the mournful trappings so closely associated with transition were to be ruthlessly cast out. Is not the event, at the present day, sufficiently harrowing in itself without adding to its gloom by the adoption of so much black? This, I am afraid, is a slight digression. To return. We are given the name, but not the address of the person upon whom we are to attend. Indeed, the whole procedure is far simpler, and gives a very good example of what I mentioned but a moment ago regarding the relative simplicity of life in our world as compared with the complexities of life in yours. Everything, you will say, must have a beginning, so that some indication must be given somewhere by someone to someone that the passing of a particular person is about to take place, within, shall we say, a matter of an hour or two of earthly time. It is hardly likely, things being what they are, that a direct message would be sent out to us from Earth people intimating that assistance was required at an imminent dissolution. It is not my purpose, at this moment, to trace matters to their source, and, strictly speaking, we who undertake this kind of work are not concerned with the minutiae of organization which terminate with our presenting ourselves at the side of the passing soul. That is part of the expert economic functions that are but a commonplace in spirit lands. This, however, can be said, the knowledge that a transition is about to take place, together with its precise location, is the result of a remarkable conveyance of information, passed from one to another, commencing with that important functionary, the individual's personal spirit guide, and terminating with us who undertake the work of escorting folk from the earth world to their homes in the spirit world. Between the former and the latter there is a clear concatenation of minds, if I may so express it, an exchange of information carried out by thought transmission, accurately and rapidly. At the present moment, as Ruth and I were seated before our friend of the central office, all that remained was to receive our sailing directions. These were given to us in this manner: our friend sent a message, by thought, of course, to the spirit person who was in attendance at the place of dissolution, to the effect that we were ready to assume charge whenever he deemed it advisable. This brought an instantaneous response. We could perceive the light as it flashed to our friend, and by a sort of confluence we were brought into the thought beam. We were now in direct rapport with our attendant friend. At the other end, as you would say. And now, to use very unscientific language, we had but to project ourselves along this thought beam to find ourselves in the exact spot where our services were needed. How this happens, I have not the remotest notion. All the truth or I could tell you is what we do, how we do it, but not how it happens. Do you believe you could describe in simple terms or any terms precisely what you do when you think, and having done that, tell me how it happens? Try that simple experiment for yourselves, and then you will understand just what I mean. We now thanked our principal for this new case, and upon his intimation that the time was close at hand, we immediately set forth. 6. Ruth and I found ourselves in a bedroom of a house of modest dimensions, unpretentious, and a moderately prosperous as far as earthly possessions were concerned. A nurse was in attendance, and relatives were close at hand. It was evident that they believed the end was not far distant, and the doctor appeared to have done all that he could to make things easier for his patient. There also seemed to be some evidence that a minister of their church had not long left the room. There are distinct signs that prayerful petitions had been sent forth, but these being couched in the usual terms of theological obscurity, and in addition being totally inapposite to the events about to take place, they were completely ineffective to achieve any purpose whatever beyond giving a doubtful satisfaction to the sitting present. This was a matter, however, that Ruth and I were quickly able and qualified to set right. We did so, asking for a downflowing of helpful power to supplement our own natural resources and abilities. It was instantly forthcoming, and was clearly observable in the bright beams of light that diffused themselves round about us. It was plain to see that in a brief space our friend would be joining us. Accordingly, we commenced our small preparations. Ruth stationed herself at the head of the bed within easy reach of the lad's head, and placing her hands upon his brow, she gently smoothed his temples. We are never certain that our ministrations are perceived or felt unless the patient reveals some sign or an oath that he or she has done so. In this case, it was patent that Ruth was making a decided impression, because coincidental with her placing her hands upon the boy's head, he turned his eyes with an upward motion as though seeking or trying to perceive whence the pleasant, soothing sensation came. From it was possible that he could actually see Ruth. If that were the case, so much the better. We had both assumed a replica of our former earthly habiliments, Ruth being attired in a gay summery garment, looking very natural and normal, and altogether charming. It is necessary to emphasize this, since it was and always is our aim to appear as unlike celestial beings, should our presence be observed, as it is possible to be. When Edwin came to meet me upon my own transition, he revealed himself to me dressed in his customary earthly attire. Had he presented himself to me in his spirit clothes, there is every reason to believe that I should have been sufficiently terrified to fancy that if the worst had not come, it could not be long delayed. I perched myself at the foot of the lad's bed, and directed my gaze upon him, and there were evident signs of his seeing me. I smiled to him, and gently waved my hand to reassure him. So far, things were proceeding very favorably. Would that all passing were as serene. The great moment in the boy's life had now arrived. I moved to a position at about the middle of the bed upon the side opposite to Ruth. The boy had lapsed into a gentle sleep. As he did so, his spirit body rose slowly above his inert physical body to which it was attached by a bright silver cord, the lifeline as it histamed. I placed my arms beneath the floating form. There was the slightest momentary twitch. The cord detached itself, retracted, and disappeared. To the relatives in the bedchamber, the boy was dead and gone. To Ruth and me he was alive and present. I held him in my arms, as one would a child, while Ruth again placed her hands upon his head. A gentle movement of her hands for a minute or two to ensure that the boy would be peacefully comfortable, and we were ready to start upon our rapid journey to our home. Throughout the transit Ruth held one of the boy's hands, thus giving him energy and strength while I supported him in my arms. The journey, as with all such journeys, was soon over. We had left the dismal bedroom, and we were in our own beautiful land and home. Quietly and gently we laid the boy upon a very comfortable couch, Ruth seating herself close beside him, as I took a chair at the foot facing our new arrival. "Well, my dear," Ruth remarked with evident satisfaction. "I really think he held you. All there was for us to do now, was to await the awakening, which, in the nature of the case, would not be long delayed. Our simple, but usually effective, arrangements had already been made. The couch upon which the lad had been laid, was placed close beneath a wide open window in such a position that, without even the slightest movement of the head, a most enchanting view was to be seen of the gardens without, while through a gap in a line of trees, a distant view of our beautiful city was to be had, clear and colorful. Upon the wall immediately facing the lad there hung a large mirror, so that the reflection of the rest of the room, with all that it suggested in comfort and ease, could be observed with the merest turn of the eye. Children's voices could be heard in the distance, and the birds were singing with their customary vigor. This was the pleasant situation awaiting our friend when he emerged from his short but refreshing sleep, and this is often the moment when our real work begins. 7. To the awakening, Ruth was the first to speak when our friend had opened his eyes. "Well, Roger," she said. "How do you feel?" Our friend at the office had given us the boy's first name, which was sufficient for all purposes. Roger opened his eyes still wider as he turned to Ruth. "Why?" said he. "I saw you. When was it?" "A little while ago." "Who are you?" "Just a friend to help you. Call me Ruth." "And you, sir?" "I seem to remember you were sitting at the foot of my bed." "That's right," I said. "The memory will become clearer in a moment or two." Roger started to sit upright, but Ruth gently pressed him back upon the cushions. "Now, Roger," said she, "the order of the day is that you just stay quietly there, and not do too much talking." The boy stared out of the window. "Lovely view, isn't it?" I said, pointing through the window. "Feeling comfortable?" "That's right." "Well, now, you are wondering what all this is about. Have you any idea what has happened?" "Only a hazy notion. But the great thing is that now you are feeling all right. All the aches and pains gone. Isn't it?" Roger nodded and smiled as the realization seemed to come upon him. "Yes, rather, thank you." The boy was obviously not of the nervous sort, and there appeared to be no purpose in withholding the truth any longer. I caught Ruth's eye, and she nodded in agreement. "Roger, my dear boy," I began, "I have some pleasant news for you. You were perfectly correct, you did see Ruth and me a little while ago. We were in your bedroom at home, and you were very ill, so ill that the doctor couldn't pull you through. So Ruth and I came to bring you through into another world, a lovely world. Do you follow?" "Then, we died. Is that it?" "That's it, old fellow. You not frightened?" "No, I don't think so." He paused. "I never expected anything like this," he added. "No, I don't suppose you did. Who does, except the very comparative few who know what's to come? Honestly, now, what did you expect?" "Goodness only knows." "Angels with large wings, and stern countenances, looking very frigid and remote? Suppose you had seen something like that, what would you have felt and thought?" "You needn't tell me, I'll answer the question for you. You would have thought that they had come to haul you off to be tried before some awful judge somewhere in the high court of heaven. And woe betide you if you had misbehaved yourself, my lad." Ruth gave a merry peal of laughter, while Roger, who had caught the look in my eye and interpreted it correctly, laughed too. "Let me tell you at once, Roger, that there are no judges, or even a single great judge, anywhere in Thizzled, the spirit world. Any judging to be done, we do it for ourselves, and manage very nicely. You'll find you will become extremely critical of yourself, as we all do. We can be very hard on ourselves even. So you may have thought about Judgment Day, dismiss the whole idea from your mind. There is no such thing, there never has been, and there never will be. Now I expect you are wondering what is to happen next," I went on. "The answer to that is simple, nothing. At least for a little while, until you feel refreshed, and then we might all go off together and explore things a bit. How does that appeal to you?" "It appeals to me very much, But there is something I would like to know. Roger looked round. Whose house is this, and who are you? I can see you are a padre, but the color of your cassock is not what I've ever seen before. As to the house, it is mine, though really it is ours, as Ruth lives most of her time with me and so does an old clergyman friend you will meet later. As to my clothes, these I am wearing are only replicas of my earthly ones which I have put on specially for you. I have proper spirit clothes, but suppose I had worn them and Ruth hers when we came to fetch you in your room, we might have looked like those grim, forbidding angels I spoke about just now. And no matter how we set our faces into pleasant looks and, smiles, there is no doubt there would have been a very frightened Roger. So, behold us as we used to be when we lived on earth, and now you look at yourself as you used to be on earth only a very short while ago. Roger glanced down at his clothes to discover that he was wearing a pair of flannel trousers and a brown jacket, while on his feet were a pair of substantial shoes. He caught hold of the material as though to reassure himself that it was real. He even clutched his arm to make doubly sure he was solid. Then he placed one foot on the floor and stamped lightly with it. All pretty solid, eh, Roger? From a side table Ruth fetched a huge bowl of fruit, and offered it to the boy. You'll find these very real, too, said she with a smile. Help yourself to what you fancy. They're lovely, and will do you a world of good. We keep them. Specially. We all three took some fruit, and Ruth and I waited till the boy tackled his. First, he looked at it closely, turning it and over in his hand. It was a plum he was examining. Seemed undecided what to do with it. There is, of course, one thing to do with a fine, juicy plum, especially if it is grown in the spirit world, and that is to eat it. Ruth did so, while Roger watched closely to see what would happen. He expected, no doubt, to see a torrent of juice run out down our clothes. His eyes opened in astonishment when saw their juice run out, certainly, and with equal certainty appear, leaving our clothes unstained. Thus encouraged followed our example, and was wild with delight at this seeming wizardry. Nothing is wasted here, Roger, explained Ruth. Everything that is unwanted returns to its source. Nothing is destroyed. You couldn't destroy anything however hard you are. If you find you no longer need or desire a thing, it will simply fade away to all appearances, just evaporate before you. But it is not lost, it will return to the source from where it came. If we didn't want this house and all its contents, it vanish, and there would be nothing to see but the ground stood on. It's the same with anything else you care to name. All things are living in the spirit world. We have things as inanimate objects. Things are managed better here than on the old earth. From the tiny bit you've seen of things so far? Roger thanked Truth for her explanation. He seemed a diffident in the matter of speaking, though, of course Ruth recommended him not to talk too much yet. However turned to me after pondering Ruth's words, with some of an air of puzzlement. Were you a bishop, or something? He asked. Oh dear, no. I laughed. Nothing so grand or exalted. You were going by the color of this garment I'm wearing. No, I was only Monsignor when I was on earth. Some of my friends there still call me by the old title. It pleases them, and does no harm, though really we have no such titles and distinguishing marks here. Still, if you would like to use the same name, do so by all means. It serves a useful purpose, and it's not against the regulations. Ruth always uses it. Here I would like to interpolate one or two observations which I think it expedient to make. What I am setting down for you is the account of an actual case, a real occurrence, though it is typical of many. The young lad, Roger, is a person of real existence, who came into the spirit world in the circumstances precisely as I am now giving you. Again, exception may be taken to the conversation as I have recounted it to you. There are folk who object that the whole of it is too appallingly flippant and trivial to merit consideration for one moment, that it is frivolous and third-rate, and such as would not, most certainly not be indulged in any region that could be properly designated. Heaven, that. Heaven.